all nine of the justices were really struggling with what is on its face, everyone admits, a very vague statute.
The Supreme Court hears Bruce Wyrock's case. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 8th of December. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a federal judge halts a timber sale in Southeast.
The court's ruling in this case recognizes that timber sales on the Tongass in pristine, roadless areas like this one are really just a waste of taxpayer money.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments this morning in the case of former Alaska State Legislator Bruce Wyrock of Juneau. The question is whether Wyrock violated what's called the Honest Services Law by asking oilfield services company VECO for a job. At the same time, he was voting on legislation affecting the company. APRN's Libby Casey reports from Washington.
The Honest Services Fraud Statute says public servants and corporate executives should honestly serve the people. Alaska state law does not require legislators to divulge their job hunting activities, but the federal government says Wyrock committed mail fraud when he mailed VECO his resume because of the Honest Services Law. Washington, D.C. attorney Don Ayer argued Wyrock's case.
He sent a solicitation letter, which was properly labeled advertising material, entirely legal, entirely proper. And the question is there some duty to disclose? And here there's no dispute. No Alaska law required it, and there's no federal statute that requires it. So what did he do wrong?
Wyrock's team argued that the Honest Services Law is too vague and does not spell out exactly what is illegal. Some Supreme Court justices seem to agree, including Chief Justice John Roberts, who said the court needs to be able to understand the law or it's not valid. Justice Antonin Scalia called the statute passed by Congress 20 years ago a mush of language. And Justice Stephen Breyer asked if the Honest Services Law applied to an average private sector employee who purposely wastes time at work and warned that if it does, 140 million Americans might be violating it. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is supporting Wyrock, and board member Timothy O'Toole says Tuesday's arguments highlight the confusion of what exactly the Honest Services Law is supposed to mean.
I think that's the question that the court's really struggling with, and it looked to me from the arguments like all the justices are struggling with this. This is not just an ideological faction. It's not just one particular justice. I think all nine of the justices were really struggling with what is on its face, everyone admits, a very vague statute.
Melanie Sloan, the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, watched Tuesday's arguments. She says even though the justices were concerned about the Honest Services Law, there's still value to it.
I still remain convinced, and I think there were justices who were troubled by this as well, that public corruption is a major part of what honest services fraud is all about. It is not mostly these private economic crimes. It's a tool for prosecutors in public corruption cases, and taking it away would really limit prosecutors' ability to target public corruption.
Sloan says based on the justices' questions, it's likely the Supreme Court will restrict the Honest Services Law or even find it unconstitutional. Wyrock's Anchorage attorney, Douglas Pope, sat at the counsel's table in the Supreme Court. He says if the court finds in his client's favor, it may derail the government's overall case against him. Pope says if the government can't claim honest services fraud, they'll have to charge the harder-to-prove quid pro quo that Wyrock got something in exchange for his vote.
If their only theory is a quid pro quo theory, then they have to have evidence that there was more than a solicitation. They have to have evidence that there was more than a negotiation. They have to have evidence that they made a deal. And, you know, we've been in this case for 2 years now. We've looked at all the evidence, and I don't see it.
The Supreme Court's decision in the case is expected next year. The justices heard arguments in two cases related to honest services fraud Tuesday, the other dealing with newspaper magnate Conrad Black, who's accused of defrauding his company. There's still one more related case on the docket, former Enron executive Jeffrey Skilling, whose lawyers will also argue that the honest services law is unconstitutionally vague. If the Supreme Court agrees, Cruz's Melanie Sloan says it could have major ripple effects.
Should, of course, the statute be held unconstitutional, that's very significant in that all the prior convictions of honest services fraud could be thrown out. And we'll see that in cases such as William Jefferson, the former Louisiana congressman who was found to have $90,000 in his freezer. Already, I think that the Justice Department has indicated it's going to redo the indictment of former Governor Rod Blagojevich so that honest services fraud isn't on the table.
But Sloan says if the Supreme Court throws out the honest services law, Congress will likely start over and create a new law. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
In rural Alaska, a steady outmigration is placing schools at risk of not having enough children enrolled to keep them open. The school in the Aleutian Islands community of Nikolsky closed this year. Joe Beckford is the superintendent for the Aleutian region. He says Nikolsky has been on the enrollment borderline for a number of years. Since 2008, they've had only 9 students, one less than the 10 required to qualify for state funding.
That doesn't meet the 10 required for a funding community. And so what we're currently doing is we are funding a part-time aide to allow kids to have access to the school and the internet.
There are only 2 other schools in the Aleutian Region District. ATCA has 15 students this year, and ADAC has 22. ATCA and ADAC both have ports, and ATCA has increased its fish processing capacity. But Beckford says Nikolsky has a lava flow across the bay, so large ships can't dock there. Beckford says the BIA built the school in Nikolsky in 1938, but he says the community is dwindling.
So it's a community that has a history of 8,000 years, and I guess maybe arguably as far back as 10,000 years. So it's a very old and ancient place, but the population is getting down to a very critical level in terms of being able to sustain services.
Eddie Jeans is the State Department of Education and Early Development's Director of School Finance and Facilities. He says this year there are 4 schools that have fallen below the 10-student threshold.
That would be False Pass in the Aleutians East Borough, Nelson Lagoon in the Aleutians East Borough, Cooper Landing in Kenai, and then Hyder in Southeast Alaska.
Jeans says there are 5 other schools at risk because they are right at the 10-student line: Akutan, Aleutian East, Danger Bay in the Kodiak Island District, and in Southeast Islands District, Kasan and Port Alexander. In Central Alaska, the Far North School is also right at 10 students. Jeans says schools in Southeast have struggled because of the decline in the timber industry.
But we are seeing it scattered throughout the state now, throughout Western Alaska and Interior Alaska, where a number of those communities, the student population is dropping.
10 or more students trigger a state base allocation of between $250,000 to $300,000. Once enrollment drops below 10, the funding falls to around $100,000. The legislature set a 10-student limit in 1998, but a hold harmless provision was passed in 2007, which gives schools 75% of their allocation the first year enrollment drops below 10 and 50% the second year. That gives schools time to try and recruit new families to their area. Tenakee Springs tried an appeal on Craigslist. Jean says the funding threshold is affecting more and more communities.
We do see a few more schools closing than we have in the past, so I think it's getting a little more attention than it has. But also, I think it's good that the legislature has responded to this issue by passing the hold harmless provision that allows areas a couple years of transition funding to try and address their issue.
Gene says school districts are still required to provide an education to students, regardless of whether their school is open or not. In Nikolsky, students are taking correspondence courses. Tanya Kyle is the Nikolsky Tribal Administrator. She says a few families may decide to leave if correspondence school requires a large investment of time, but she says the school has closed in the past in Nikolsky and reopened. She says the IRA Council has jobs available if families want to move to the island, but she says most people can't handle the lifestyle.
It's not employment that's the issue. It's just that people don't want to live here because they don't want to live in such a remote area. They'd rather have, you know, malls and movie theaters and, you know, grocery stores on every corner. And that's not something that we can compete with.
But Kyle says even though there are only a small number of families living in Nikolsky, she isn't worried about the community's future. She says many people who grew up in Nikolsky and moved to urban areas eventually move back.
Some people just aren't meant to live in a city, and I think that there will always be those few that keep wanting to come back, so I don't foresee the village drying up and blowing away anytime soon.
The state will restart funding for a community as soon as enrollment gets up to 10 or over. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, in an age of dying newspapers, a new one takes shape in Kodiak.
There it was, like on a silver platter. I just had to create it. Yeah, I just had to make it. Just had to start from complete scratch.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
One of the largest class action lawsuits ever filed against the federal government was settled today. After 13 years, the Eloise Cobell Trust Fund lawsuit was finalized for $3.4 billion. The case was first filed in 1996 to demand a fiscal reconciliation of more than 300,000 individual Indian money accounts that were mismanaged by the Department of Interior for decades. Estimates by plaintiff attorneys and accountants of how much money should have been paid to the accounts dating back to the 19th century but had gone missing through the years ranged from $20 to $100 billion. It's not immediately clear how many Alaska Natives may benefit from today's settlement. Attorney Lloyd Miller says the closure this represents after running through three administrations, numerous appeals, and two judges is important.
The president, when he was campaigning, focused on the Cobell litigation as a terrible stain on the government's honor, and said when he was elected he would work to try to resolve it. And I think he and his administration put more effort into trying to resolve it than any prior administration. This is a direct product of President Obama's commitment to Indian country.
The accounts were for Native allotment revenue that was derived from timber sales, oil, gas, and coal leases, and sales, as well as grazing leases. The money from these activities was paid to the Interior Department on behalf of the Native owners. DOI was tasked with overseeing the accounts and making annual payments to Native account holders. But extreme mismanagement, misplaced or lost funds, and stories of destroyed paper records in rodent-infested warehouses made it impossible to get an accurate historical accounting. With today's settlement, $1.4 billion will be paid to account holders for an average payment of between $1,000 to $1,500, and $2 billion will be used to consolidate and create efficiencies in the system. Lloyd Miller says there are fewer than 150,000 Native allotments throughout the U.S., but more than 4 million owners of those lands. Miller says the $2 billion will be used to purchase what are called fractionated interest in the allotments.
Since some of these fractionated owners are so tiny, the amount of money to purchase their interest is also tiny. So they probably don't have an incentive to really sell their interest, to do anything. So a special fund is set up involving $60 million to offer scholarships to those individuals as an added incentive to undertake a transaction.
One example was for a 40-acre parcel with more than 400 owners. The land generated $1,000 per year, but cost the Interior Department $40,000 per year to administer. Interior Department officials say reducing the number of individual trust accounts will greatly reduce administrative expenses. 5% of the value of these interests will be set aside in an account for Native student scholarships. The settlement must still be approved by the U.S. District Court. Congress must also authorize it. A federal judge has halted the Orion North timber sale on Revillagigedo Island. As KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the 4 million board foot sale was one of 25 timber sales offered on the Tongass this year.
In 1999, the Forest Service authorized the 51 million board foot sea level timber sale, which was comprised of a handful of smaller sales in the Thorn Arm area of Revillagigedo Island, including Orion North. Since that time, the Orion North sale has been the subject of numerous court battles as conservation groups have sued to stop the sale. In a ruling Monday, U.S. District Court Judge John Sedgwick sided with the conservation groups and issued an injunction temporarily halting the sale. Sedgwick ruled that the Forest Service needed to address changes in timber economics through the preparation of a Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement, or SEIS, before proceeding with Orion North. In his 22-page ruling, Sedgwick said the Forest Service's decision not to prepare an SEIS looking at changes in timber economics was arbitrary, capricious, and a violation of the National Environmental Protection Act. Kate Glover is an attorney with Earth Justice, which represented six conservation groups in the case. She says the Forest Service used out-of-date information in leading up to the decision to award the Orion North timber sale to Ketchikan's Pacific Log and Lumber in July.
So now, for this timber sale, it would cost taxpayers 11 times as much to build the road alone, to build the road to access the timber, as the Forest Service would receive in revenue for selling the trees. And so the court recognized that those changes are significant and the Forest Service needs to look back at these dramatic changes in the economics of the sale.
Since President Obama was elected, Orion North is the only timber sale that has been offered on the Tongass that includes inventoried roadless areas.
This is an area that's important to people in Ketchikan in particular, and it's a pristine area, one of the last remaining roadless areas on Thorn Arm. And it's important for wildlife, such as deer and other animals in that area. And I think that the court's ruling in this case recognizes that timber sales on the Tongass in pristine roadless areas like this one are really just a waste of taxpayer money.
The Orion North sale would take place over around 205 acres. The sale calls for the construction of nearly 5 miles of new roads, around 2 miles of reconstructed roads, and another 1 mile of temporary roads. As of October, approximately 1.3 miles of new road had already been constructed, but timber had yet to be harvested. Alaska Forest Association Executive Director Owen Graham says Pacific Log and Lumber is in dire need of timber to operate its mill.
Pacific Log and Lumber hasn't been able to operate this year because of a lack of economic timber.
Pacific Log and Lumber owner Steve Seeley did not return phone calls by deadline. Graham says the Orion North lawsuit is not about economics of timber sales and instead is part of a long-term strategy by conservationists to shut down the timber industry.
It's old growth timber, but the problem is just the same as it's been, is our young growth is 50 years from being mature, and so we either continue logging old growth for the next 50 years or we shut down completely. The environmental groups obviously want to shut down completely.
The Forest Service declined to comment on Judge Sedgwick's decision. Tonga spokesperson Aaron Uloth says the agency is still reviewing the decision. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
More North Pole wells are coming up positive for the chemical solvent sulfalane. Department of Environmental Conservation Contaminated Sites Project Manager Ann Ferris says the pollution from historic spills at the Flint Hills refinery is more widespread than previously thought.
They have identified approximately 30 wells, private wells, that have detections of sulfalane in them.
So far, all off-site well samples have come in far below an existing 350 parts per billion cleanup standard. Sulfalane is not a regulated drinking water contaminant, and it's unclear how dangerous it is for human consumption at such low concentrations. Ferris says results of a toxicity review by the State Department of Health are expected out soon. She says some of the sulfalane-contaminated wells are nearly a mile away from the refinery, and Flint Hills is expanding the scope of well testing and precautions.
Notification letters have gone out to homes north of the homes already identified, and there'll be ongoing sampling. Now, all of the wells that have been sampled, the people have been provided with bottled water, or Flint Hills is working with them to provide them bottled water.
The state is also keeping watch on the city of North Pole's public water system. One of two city wells earlier tested positive for contamination and was taken offline. There's only one known release of sulfalane at the refinery, a 150-gallon spill in 2002. But gasoline also contains the chemical, and leaching from historic gas spills is believed to be the primary source of the sulfalane affecting localized groundwater.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Attention hunters, you must apply now for all drawing hunts and for all Tier 1 and Tier 2 hunts in 2010 and in 2011. There's no application period in the spring of 2010. Applications must be postmarked by December 15th, so get your application in the mail now, or you can apply online until December 31st. Information online at wildlife.alaska.gov or 1-907-267-2257. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Former Alaska Anchorage Representative Ralph Samuels today joined the 2010 race for the governor's office. Samuels says he wants to focus on the state's economic future.
Budget keeps going up. The oil production keeps going down. We need to step back and go, we need a 10-year picture. And it's the normal body politic does not usually think that way. And that it will be your sole goal almost is to start thinking long term so that, you know, we've all got a future together and we've got an economy that we can grow on.
Samuel served 6 years in the legislature, stepping down as majority leader of the House of Representatives after the 2008 session. He currently works as a vice president of Holland America Cruise Lines. He joins Governor Parnell, former House Speaker John Harris, and former Valdez Mayor Bill Walker in the Republican primary next August. Senator Mark Begich today introduced an amendment to the health care legislation now before Congress that would expand a demonstration program offering support to small hospitals. For the past 5 years, the Rural Community Hospital Demonstration Project has been assisting 15 hospitals nationally, three of them in Alaska. The Begich amendment would extend the program for 5 more years and expand it to 30 small hospitals around the country.
Look at what we're doing at creating more efficient, more innovation, better cost containment. How do we improve on that? And this one has clearly proven to be a successful program, extending rural community health, community hospital demonstration project. So this is to move it into a higher level of utilization. We believe that this will show, again, 5 years from now, why we need to continue this and expand it even further, especially as it's designed for rural community hospitals.
The Alaska hospitals currently in the system are Juneau's Bartlett Regional Hospital, Central Peninsula Hospital in Soldotna, and Mount Edgecombe Hospital in Sitka. The Begich Amendment is part of a larger legislative package of 11 amendments introduced by freshman Democrats. Begich says he expects completed action on the entire health care legislation within the next 10 days. Kodiak College has a new student newspaper called The Emerald Looking Glass. KMXT's Diana Gish has the story of how it came to be.
Vince Lombardi said that once a man has made a commitment to a way of life, he puts the greatest strength in the world behind him. Lombardi could have been describing Alicia Briggs. She's the editor of Kodiak College's new student newspaper. Publishing The Emerald Looking Glass was a dream come true for the 26-year-old student and mother of two.
What really started it is I applied at the Daily Mirror, and they had told me that, you know what I mean, they wanted a little bit more experience, but that they were willing to let me freelance. And I wrote this article for them, and it came out in the back-to-school edition, and I laminated it when it came out, and I put it on my wall, and I thought every single day that's like what I want to do with my life. And then I got the calling to go back to school, and when I went to school, they didn't have a paper, and I'm like, well, I want to create the paper. And then Jared Griffin was like, well, we have the money to do it. And then there it was, like, on a silver platter. I just had to create it. Yeah, I just had to make it. Just had to start from complete scratch.
While the opportunity seemed to come easily, the process of creating the paper wasn't always as smooth.
Getting people together to do something like that is just really, it's really hard. You know, the first meeting, there was like one person there, and I was so discouraged. I mean, don't get me wrong. I've been discouraged, you know. I mean, that's completely normal. But the important thing is keeping your head up and staying with it as many times as you just get discouraged. And when the first issue came out, it is like you almost want to cry because you're so happy because you finally got what you wanted.
Briggs' enthusiasm took her on sales calls to solicit funding for the paper. In the middle of her sales pitch, she realized she had no idea what she was doing. Briggs went to Richard Harris of the Kodiak Daily Mirror, who gave her a quick lesson on how to sell advertising for the paper. He also offered to print the first edition of the paper for free. The paper was Briggs' dream, but it required a team of people to bring it into reality. One of the people on her long list of those to thank is the paper's advisor.
I thank Sue Jeffries. She put in so much of her time, stayed late with me. We stayed till like 10, 11 o'clock at night at the school, you know, printing out like the last layout of the paper to look it over so it could be proofread one last time. And I mean, we were so tired. We could barely even like walk. We didn't even know what we were talking about at one point because we were so tired, but we still pulled through.
Sue Jeffrey, who works as an assistant at the Kodiak College Library, is equally enthusiastic about the newspaper and its editor.
She has a lot of leadership skills, I think, and pulled together a diverse and enthusiastic staff, and she's the one that started it, really.
Briggs said that for the first edition, she gathered together people that she knew could write, but she hopes to see as many people as possible contribute to the Emerald Looking Glass. I'm Diana Gish.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Diana Gish in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. If you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free, and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-7848. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.